This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, Brazil did it. Montana is working on it. California gets all the credit for trying it. But can New York do it too? I'm talking about energy independence. The governor of New York, George Pataki, has set a goal for the state. And in 7 years, that goal is one quarter of the state's electricity will come from renewable resources like wind, hydropower, biofuels. That's a pretty ambitious goal. In this hour, we're going to look at how the state of New York is working to meet that goal, and we'll take a look at plans to develop alternative fuel resources in the state. Governor says he wants to install biodiesel pumps all along the state's main highway, the New York State Thruway, so that biodiesel will be pumped into biodiesel cars. We'll talk about that. We're broadcasting from Syracuse, New York this hour on the campus of the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. And if you'd like to get on our conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you're welcome to surf over to our website, or even easier here, if you're in the audience, we invite you to step up to our microphones on the sides and ask questions of our guests. And let me introduce them right now. Cornelius B. Murphy, who likes to be called Neil, is president of the State University of New York College of Environmental Sciences and Forestry. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Murphy.
Oh, thank you, Ira. Great to have you here.
You're welcome. William Moore is the director of development for PPM Energy. That is one of the developers of the Maple Ridge Wind Farm. We're going to talk about that wind farm. He's also on the board of directors of the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. Thanks for being with us today, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Edward Bogish is the executive director of the Syracuse Center for Excellence in Environmental and Energy Systems at Syracuse University. Thanks for being with us today.
It's a privilege. Thanks.
And Carol Murphy is the executive director at the Alliance for Clean Energy in New York. Thank you for being with us today, Ms. Murphy.
Thanks, Simon.
Now, let me start with you. This is a pretty ambitious plan for the state of New York, is it not? To wean yourself off the foreign oil and use renewables. How far along are we, and what is the overall plan here in New York State?
Well, I think New York has certainly established leadership in this area by Governor Pataki's executive order, and we have in place NYSERDA, which is New York State Energy Research Development Authority, who for some time has actually been working on energy efficiency and promoting clean technologies and renewables. So we had a good base to begin with. New York is blessed with the fact that we do have natural resources like hydro power.
We mean that big falls down the block.
Now, we actually get 19% of our energy from renewable resources, primarily hydro. Solar and wind are a little less than 1% each of that right now, but hopefully that will change. And I think the policies that have been put forward by the governor and being implemented are really ones that are moving us in that area. And what I've seen just living in Albany in the capital region is definitely an excitement, because there has been new investment in new technologies like fuel cells. Plug Power is right in Albany. MTI, Daystar, photovoltaic company was lured from California and has opened a facility in New York. Certainly, you know, there's a lot of interest and investment. When you see a Goldman Sachs and a J.P. Morgan that are now investing dollars into wind and into these technologies, you know, I definitely think that we have the potential to not only reach 25% of energy coming from renewables, but even exceed that.
Let me ask Bill Moore to talk about the wind farms, the Maple Ridge wind farm that I know that you helped start and part owner of. What is the potential for wind in the state of New York?
Well, upstate New York has a potential of 3,000 megawatts, if not more. 10% of electricity used in New York State, Ira, could come from just wind power alone. By the way, I'm not a co-owner of Maple Ridge. I wish I were, but PPM Energy and Horizon Wind Energy are the two co-owners. Mm-hmm. This one wind farm on the Tug Hill Plateau will supply 2% of all the electricity used in the residential sector in New York State from one wind farm. Effectively, one out of 50 households in New York State will get their electricity on an annual average basis from this one wind farm.
And how many, what would we see? How many wind turbines are there that you have, and what is the potential for expanding that?
Well, we installed 120 last year, 1.65 megawatt generators, each on a 82-meter tall tower. In fact, as I was leaving Tug Hill this morning, they were setting some additional turbines. By the end of this year, we'll have 195 separate generators installed along a 12.5-mile-long project area and 75 contiguous dairy farms. So it's really it's one of the largest infrastructure projects built in northern New York. And there are another 30 to 40 wind farms, not quite as big as this, but on the drawing board elsewhere in upstate New York.
Also, there's one in Long Island. Is there not off the coast there?
Well, there is one that's been proposed by the Long Island Power Authority, and it's working its way through the permitting process, and we're very, very pleased to see that. I mean, the wind potential in New York is sort of evenly distributed from the shores of Lake Ontario and Lake Erie in the north all the way to Long Island Sound and the Atlantic Ocean in the south.
Mm-hmm. Neil, is conservation going to play a role here in reducing the fossil fuel use? And let me ask this a bit. What do you think? Is conservation going to...
Conservation is important. As we look for solutions to the energy challenges around the world, you have to look at both sides of the equation, both the supply and the consumption. Mm-hmm. One of the areas of tremendous opportunity for efficiencies involves the design of buildings. Buildings account for 40% of the use of energy across the country, around the world, and there are opportunities to integrate technologies for renewable energy generation, such as photovoltaics, wind power, and others, in the design and in the construction of buildings, reducing the consumption of energy on site.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the quickest fix, is it not, for a long-term solution is conservation. If you wanted to
cut down
on the immediate drawing of electricity.
It's a critical part of the long-term solution. If you take the long view, you look at the history of humanity, and let's kind of fast forward ahead 2,000 years and look back on this time. I think people will look back at this era and see that as a people around the world, we had an affair with petroleum that lasted about 300 years, and we're right in the middle of it right now. We took a big drink of an energy supply, and then that supply was exhausted. And as we look for alternative energy sources, we also need to look at how we use energy and develop alternative means of meeting the needs of society.
Mm-hmm. Neil Murphy, I know that your institution is working on something really interesting, on turning willow trees into ethanol. We haven't heard much about willow trees, but the state of New York knows all about willow trees, doesn't it?
Well, certainly, Ira, we're trying to educate the state of New York all about willow trees.
Mm-hmm.
It really stems from our northern hardwood forests. In New York State, we've got 18.5 million forested acres in New York State. And they're really, much of that acreage is made up by our northern hardwoods. And there's a compound or a series of compounds in those hardwoods called hemicellulose. And what we're looking at is how can we extract the hemicellulose from the northern hardwood chips, convert the hemicellulose to 5-carbon sugars, ferment the 5-carbon sugars into ethanol.
Ethanol. And what makes that tree so good a candidate rather than other corn or other kinds of wood sources?
Well, I think, Ira, I think the principal thing is the energy balance that's involved. Generally, I think in agriculture, most people view that if you use corn as a basis for making ethanol, you get roughly 1.6, 1.67 units of energy out for every unit of energy you put in. In the case of our northern hardwoods, the numbers are probably more in the range of about for every unit of energy in, you get 14 units to maybe 16 or 18 units
really?
Of energy out. Absolutely.
Wow, that's an incredible ratio. Can you actually harvest and regrow willow? I mean, is it...
that
We need to know the ABCs of this.
Yeah,
it sounds so promising.
That's exactly it. We believe a concept of agroforestry. And in New York State, we've got 600,000 acres of forested land that are currently not engaged... ag land not currently engaged in agriculture. They've got another 600,000 acres of land that are probably a little too wet to be ag land. Literally, we, through the Salix Project, can literally grow our biomass on that 1.2 million acres of land, give a return to our agricultural community, and help wean us off the petroleum base, particularly for transportation fuels.
And how long would it take to grow a tree from a seedling to make it harvestable for energy?
Well, we can start with a 6-inch sprig, and literally, and that shoot might only be about a quarter of an inch in diameter. And in 3 years, it's 30 feet tall, and the basic structure of the tree is about 2.5 or 3 inches in diameter.
It's 30 feet tall in 3 years?
30 feet tall, absolutely.
So then you could harvest it to make ethanol out of it and then replant it?
That's exactly it. We can.
It's just like what people do to make plywood now, of these forests.
In a similar way, only we would harvest it in a shorter cycle, harvest on a 3-year cycle instead of maybe a 10 or 15 year cycle.
And how close is this technology to becoming useful?
Well, Ira, we think that we can get this in play potentially in as short of as 2 to 3 years, and that's what we're focusing on.
The actual chemistry of making it all work.
Absolutely.
And what's the stumbling block to getting this going?
Usually, Iron, anything like this, it comes down to dollars.
Ah, we're back to money.
Absolutely. But we're really fortunate to have Governor Pataki, who really accepted this as a vision for New York State, much the way Carol had mentioned. And he's committed $20 million as seed money to get this process moving. And there is a solicitation that will be out on the street, and we expect that those monies will be distributed before the end of the year.
And other states could watch this and just emulate you with the willow.
Well, we know there are a lot of states that are watching. We had Congressman Bass in from New Hampshire, Congressman Charlie Bass, a great guy, and he said if it can work in New York State, it's got to work in New Hampshire.
You know what they say, if you can make it here. So let me end with that, because we have to take a break, and we'll come back and take all your questions and to talk more about alternative energies in the state of New York with Carol Murphy, Bill Moore, Neil Murphy, and Ed Bogish. So stay with us. Stay on the phones. We'll take your calls after this break. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about New York State's efforts to become energy independent. My guests are Neil Murphy, president of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry, William Moore, director of development for PPM Energy, one of the developers of the Maple Ridge Wind Farm, which is right here in New York. Edward Bogish is Executive Director of the Syracuse Center of Excellence in Environmental and Energy Systems at Syracuse University. Carol Murphy, Executive Director at the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Carol, you know, as someone who grew up in the 60s and watched the environmental movement of the 70s, what happened to it? You know, what happened? Why is Brazil now almost energy independent, having started in the 70s, continued with its alternative fuel systems, but we're still locked into the oil from the oil crisis back then?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, I've been in the energy business for some 25 years, and back in the first Arab oil embargo in 1979, Congress passed PURPA in order to get us off foreign oil, renewables, energy efficiencies, all things that sound familiar as we sit here today. And there was development in New York and elsewhere for small hydro, gas-burning cogen plants, kind of innovations in solar and elsewhere. And we did lose our way. We kind of got complacent, and, you know, oil prices came back down. Natural gas was cheap and plentiful, and that development stopped. And, you know, we did become, you know, complacent and happy, and the innovations really that should have been going along didn't. And I think a lot of that is just really due to the fact that prices were low. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had sufficient energy in this country, so we kind of forgot about it. And now here we sit today with people going to the gas pump and having really sticker shock when you go to fill up your pump, energy prices high, real concerns about where do we get fossil fuels. Certainly, you know, we made an investment here in New York in nuclear as well, and then we know what happened with Three Mile Island and right. you know, other concerns about continuing that. So I think really the time is come back around for people to say, hey, we forgot about it. It was a great idea. Certainly, it contributes to energy independence. It's emissions-free. You don't have the world politics influencing your energy production in New York when you're using things right. like, you know, ethanol right. and wind and hydro and solar, and it's energy independence right within the state.
Ed Bogish?
I think you think back, you made the connection in your question to the environmental movement of the 60s. And I think there was a lot of results of the environmental movement of the 60s. In particular, we focused on the environment. Remember, 1969, a lot of things happened. And one thing happened in July, men landed on the moon, fulfilling the challenge that had been made by JFK. And then another thing that happened in 69 was the Cuyahoga River burned in Cleveland, Ohio. And I think those things happening one right after another, that was the tipping point for the public consciousness that, hey, we can go to the moon and rivers are burning, something's wrong, and we need to focus on the environment. Smokestacks are belching, rivers are on fire, and the EPA started in 1970, so for 35 years we've been focusing on the environment decoupled from energy. And now when people go to the pump, as Carol says, they get hit every day, every week with the message that something's wrong with energy. Also, we see pictures on covers of national magazines about you know, polar bears looking at the reflection in water and horrific storms. And I think that we're passing a public tipping point of opinion that makes the connection between environment and energy. Mm-hmm. And we've got the public attention now. And now we will focus on making the connections between environment and energy.
It also seems that you also have a better business model now than you had back then, right? I mean, people thought of that saving energy, conservation, you know, you see the solar powered units there for some place in third world countries, you know, but now there seems to be, Neil, like, an opportunity for actually businesses to take advantage of this technology.
Ira, absolutely. Even the President Bush's plan on biofuels, even by his own numbers, which I think are conservative, suggest that we could create a new economy in the area of biofuels, employing 174,000 new people in that marketplace. So there is that absolute connection between the renewable energy mandate, creating a new sustainable economy, and as Dr. Bogish mentioned, minimizing our carbon footprint.
Mm. And you also seem to have to take up the slack that the federal government has left the states to do on their own. I mean, there's no real national energy initiative or policy that, so California, Montana, you folks have to do it on your own.
I think that's absolutely correct. When you think about it, it may be a good thing, Ira, that we have, for example, the number of states that belong to the Ethanol Coalition. I think there may be 23 states. When you look at the issue of the number of cities, you know, and I know you're going to talk later about San Antonio and Eugene, Oregon, and all those other cities, grassroots making a fundamental change and making a commitment, our own city of Syracuse being one of them.
1-800-989-8255. Our mics are open. I know there's going to be a flood to them when the first one gets there and the rest of you are left out. So I'm going to remind you to try to go. Oh, we have someone at the mic on the left side. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi. I have one comment and one question. I guess it's hard for me to believe when people go to the pump in a 7,000-pound vehicle, they sort of forgot about, you know, the 60s and the 70s. That's just a comment. I mean, it's if they're the sole driver of that vehicle, you know, it's hard to believe they need something that big.
Hmm. And your question?
I guess I'm concerned that we're focused on growing our way out of our fuel crisis. And has anybody done any comprehensive review of exactly the environmental impact of ethanol or willow trees, how much land we're going to need? Mm-hmm. I think Lester Brown said if we turned the entire state of Nebraska over to ethanol production, we'd have 5 days of fuel. in this country.
Neil Murphy?
Sure. Some of those are real issues. I think some estimates have been made that to offset a million barrels of oil, you need basically a billion tons of biomass. And there's no question that we need to look very carefully at some of those things. But equally, I think, Ira, there needs to be balance in our approach to renewable energy. There is not going to be any single one solution. It's going to require a number of different sources of renewable energy, using biomass as a source, indigenous sources of biomass. And we need to take a balanced approach. Not the total solution to our problem certainly isn't willow and certainly isn't ethanol from willow. Mm-hmm. We need a lot of different solutions that are appropriate for the areas that would use that renewable energy.
Bill Moore, how do you decide where you can put a wind farm? And how much land do you need? And, you know, we hear the other side saying, these things are so noisy, I don't want one in my backyard.
Well, Ira, come up to the Tug Hill and listen for yourself. You know, I think that on average we need about 60 acres of open space in order to accommodate the much larger rotor diameters we see in today's megawatt-scale wind turbine generators. But our actual footprint is only about a half to an acre of space occupied by our turbine foundations and access roads. So commercial wind farming is actually a terrific complement to conventional farming. And that's why you see so many wind farms being installed on dairy farms here in places like New York.
Do they get paid, the farmers, for having
them? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think in Maple Ridge, we'll end up paying $2 million a year in royalties to our landowning farmers.
Yeah. So, like, they can't make any money selling milk anymore. But they might make some money.
It's absolutely tough. And I think a lot of our supporters are pleased to see this kind of investment made in a farming town, because it'll help preserve the economy of some of these smaller towns and also allow some of these landowners to hold on to their family farms, because, as you say, milk revenue is not going to help them do it.
Mm-hmm. How much of the grid in the United States, if we were to expand this, when we talk about a major, let's say, wind farm resource, do we need a grid where we can all feed the central system? Because where the wind is may not be where all the grid extends to, and I'm thinking of, you know, North Dakota, places like that. Or is it going to be localized, Carol? Let me ask you this
Ira,
question.
I'll address this, because for the past 5 years I was over at the New York Independent System Operator. They are the ones who operate the grid in New York State. And you can accommodate, they estimated, over 3,000 megawatts of wind in the state right now without having to make any additional upgrades or to incorporate, you know, any additional building to the grid. And the grid is flexible enough to accommodate highs and lows in demand. I'll give you one of the best examples when there's stress on the system. You might think I'm going to say that, you know, it's a really hot summer day, which certainly does stress the system, but Christmas tree lights, everybody's got them on timers. We see the spike go up like astronomically when everybody has their lights on the timer. So, you know, the grid is flexible enough to really accommodate those highs and lows. So we need additional megawatts in New York. But also, I'd just like to address the gentleman's question. If you go to our website, and I'm going to put a shameless plug in here because it's a good source of information for people about renewables and what we're doing in New York, which is www.acny.org, we do embrace energy conservation as part of it. It isn't just one thing. It's not just the hydro, the wind. Energy conservation and efficiency has to be part of the solution.
Well, you know, we've been talking about this for years now, about wind and energy. I remember we did a show years ago. We had farmers from Oklahoma saying, how do I get one of these, you know, on my ranch, because I'd love to have them. And it's also, while we're talking about Oklahoma, it's interesting to note that Texas is the second largest installed base of it's hard to get your head around that. But whenever we do a show on alternative energy or solar wind or solar or whatever, we get the same complaint from people. And that basically is they can't tap into the grid. You know, they can't feed it back into the grid. If you want to put up a windmill and sell power back to your utility company, make the meter run backwards.
You can in New York.
You can do that.
Yes. New York actually had the first solar net metering bill. Wind, they actually do for residential wind and for farm wind projects, and as well as biomass.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have net metering. You can actually get money back from the utility. So.
Okay, well, let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flato, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We're here in Syracuse, New York, talking about New York State's efforts at alternative energy with my guests Neil Murphy, William Moore, Edward Bogish, and Carol Murphy. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to this side of the room. Yes, ma'am.
I have a dollars and cents type question. We can choose our alternate energy producers in New York State. Right now, I choose a green producer, so my electricity is a combination of wind, biomass, and hydro. For my being a good socially responsible person, I'm paying an extra penny per kilowatt. How can the state get more people to use green energy if it's going to cost the consumers more money to do that?
Well, so actually, the RPS program, which we discussed earlier, Governor Pataki's initiative that will require all electricity generators in New York State, I'm sorry, all electricity sellers in New York State to procure an increasing percentage of their electricity from green sources. And this will expand as the voluntary market, which you referred to, also expands. It is a mandatory kind of purchase requirement. And what it does is make it possible for us to finance our very capital-intensive electricity projects, wind and solar projects, by virtue of creating another revenue stream for the owners of these projects. And so the RPS is a critical part of making this all happen. And it will drastically increase the supply of green power in the state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You briefly touched on the involvement of the federal government or the lack thereof. Do you feel that as we are facing an oil crisis and as President Bush in his State of the Union address said we are addicted to oil, do you feel that the federal government does have almost an obligation to be helping with funding these alternative fuels, or do you think it's better left up to the states?
I'll ask Neil, you want to
take
a crack at that?
I think in anything like this, it's got to be a partnership. It's got to be a partnership at the state and local level. It's got to be a partnership at the federal level. And I think that the business community has to be part of it. Clearly, we've got to create some incentives in the federal level to allow business to move into some of these areas and create some of these opportunities in order to, as Bill suggests, get sufficient capacity out there that we get the incremental cost to be lower.
What kind of incentive? Would it be tax breaks or research?
I think it's probably got to be a combination of things. I think certainly tax breaks for those that go into the renewable area. I think in the case of research and development, to come up with more efficient photovoltaics and a wide range of different technologies. So I think it's a combination of those.
Mm-hmm. And do you see them forthcoming? Do you see any interest in the government to do that?
Well, we have a congressman, Sherry Bullard, who I know you know in the adjacent district to where we're in, who definitely feels as though this has to move forward, and he sponsored a number of bills to move in this direction, and I think we need to support him.
Are you surprised that the governor has been so forthright in his support?
The governor of New York State is a conservationist and really an environmentalist at heart. And he's really grabbed hold of this and I think provided a lot of leadership in New York State, and I think we're lucky for it.
Well, you know, Brian Schweitzer of Montana says he's going to be the next wind energy person and try to beat out every other state. So you have some competition on your hand. Yes, Edward.
Just to build on the comment from Dr. Murphy, we've got a great example here in Syracuse and across upstate of a partnership between the state and support at the federal level through the center that I lead, the Syracuse Center of Excellence. This is a federation of partners across upstate established by Governor Pataki in June 2002 that has received more than $50 million of investment from the state and more than $30 million of federal funds that have been secured by our local congressman, James Walsh. Mm-hmm. So that demonstrates the partnership that Dr. Murphy was talking about, both federal and state sources working together to develop solutions that are appropriate for a particular geographic region.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you just get the auto companies to jump in and
We'd welcome an auto company to join us.
Make more energy efficient cars. We're going to have to take a short break. We're going to come back more and take more questions from our audience and from you listening in your cars or homes, wherever you're out in the garden, whatever you're doing. My guests, Neil Murphy, William Moore, Edward Bogish, and Carol Murphy, talking about energy conservation, alternative energies in New York State. Possibly you can share with us what's going on in your state and feeling the competition there. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about New York State's efforts to become more energy independent with my guest, Neil Murphy, president of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry, William Moore, director of development for PPM Energy, one of the developers of the Maple Ridge Wind Farm right here in New York, Edward Bogish, executive director of the Syracuse Center for Excellence in Environmental and Energy Systems at Syracuse University, Carol Murphy, Executive Director at the Alliance for Clean Energy in New York. Our number, 1-800-999-8255. Ed, tell us about this new building.
We're really excited about it.
What describe it for us and what the aim of the building is.
The aim of the building is to push technology to improve buildings, to make better buildings. We're building a headquarters for our federation. So we have more than 70 different partners. We have 10 different academic institutions. This headquarters will serve as a place for our partners to come and test their new ideas, to develop new products, to make buildings more efficient and better inside. Mm-hmm. This is a tremendous need and opportunity for society.
Well, tell me the kinds of things that would be in this building that would make it. It's not a parking lot you're talking about.
No.
Making it a better building to a lot of people can mean better parking in the building, but
right.
I know that's not what you're talking about.
We're talking about better indoor environments and lower impact on the surrounding environment to improve the sustainability of urban ecosystems. So we're building a building that's about 80,000 square feet. Kind of a typical office building with 7 floors, a variety of different technologies that improve its operation. We're following the guidelines of a national organization called the U.S. Green Building Council, mm-hmm. which has come up with a rating system for green buildings.
But you haven't told me a thing about what's in this building yet, Ed.
fair enough. So lots of things.
Feels like an interview I did 3 weeks ago.
Hard to know where to start. So,
how do you heat this building? I'll ask you the question. You get that. How do you heat and cool this building?
Thanks very much. The first thing we're going to do is use the energy that is available in the ground at the site. Mm-hmm. So in Syracuse, the ground below about 3 or 4 feet is about 50 degrees year-round. So we're drilling wells. We'll circulate water into these wells. And in the summertime, that water coming back from the wells can be used for cooling. And in the wintertime, it can be used to preheat the air coming into the building. Mm-hmm. Other things we're doing, we're conserving water. We're collecting rainwater from the roof. We'll use it to flush our toilets. We'll deliver air and to individual occupants, creating personal oases at the desktop. You talk to people in typical commercial office buildings or resident or schools around the country. Our technologies for delivering environments to people are one-size-fits-all technology. Mm-hmm. In fact, our design guidelines say that if 80% of the people in a particular space don't complain, that's success.
Wow.
So if 20% of the people complain, that's okay.
Right.
We envision revolutionary new technologies that will satisfy each occupant individually and also reduce overall energy consumption in the building. We're looking at a building that will consume maybe 50-70% less than a typical building built in a location like Syracuse.
So you're trying to do an Amory Lovins on your office building.
We follow Amory Lovins is a giant who has we've drawn a lot of inspiration from, and that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. How close to, you know, zero energy usage can you go? You said you could try to cut in half the present consumption. How far down can you?
The best building is no building, right? No energy. And one thing we can learn a lot from is the designs of buildings by the indigenous peoples of any region. So if we look across the United States at the indigenous peoples, you look at the types of buildings that they constructed for centuries, those buildings were in tune with their local environment. So Native Americans in the Southwest had a particular type of building design. Native Americans in New York State, known as the Haudenosaunee, the people of the Longhouse had a particular kind of design of a building that was in tune with the environment. Mm-hmm. So those are actually, this is kind of back to the future, we're studying now in our current practice how to design buildings that optimize the available use of resources locally. Mm-hmm. And take advantage of what's available locally.
Let's go to the phones. Andrew in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hi, Andrew. Are you there? Andrew, are you there? Well, let's try it again. I'll try it one more time. I think it's not working too well. Let me go to the audience here. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you. I heard a reference earlier to something called plug power. And when I hear that, I think of plugging the car into the wall at night. Well, if 75% of our energy is still going to be coming from non-renewable resources, doesn't that mean that 75% of plug power comes from non-renewable resources? And is that solving any problems, or is that pushing it around?
Plug Power is actually a fuel cell company. That's what they do is fuel cells. So.
Well, is it cheaper? Well, let's talk about that because you know there are electric cars and there are even kits now that they'll take your Prius and allow you to plug it into the wall overnight. Is that more efficient? Is that an efficient way to run a car, or is it the gasoline hybrid model a more efficient way?
I'll let someone talk about the fuel aspect of it, but just from in terms of what it would cost and what it does to the system. Power is cheaper at night. The most expensive power is during the peak time during the day, and in particularly kind of that, 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock time. So even just from, an energy efficiency standpoint in your own home, run the dishwasher at night, do your laundry at night. You know, if you have something that can be set on a timer, use that. So if you were plugging your car in, your electric vehicle in, and charging it, it certainly costs you a lot less than charging it during the day. So, and the system runs 24 hours. There's power being produced night and day. They don't just, flip the switch and turn off some of these big units. So, and hydropower runs night and day.
Ed?
I think the key thing to recognize about this question is the goal that Governor Pataki has set for 2013 is a step forward on a long journey. This is akin to JFK saying by the end of the decade we're going to go to the moon. The governor saying by 2013 we're going to get to 25% renewable energy, and then we go beyond. Now, 200 years from now, it's all going to be renewable.
If we're still all right, let me go to this gentleman over here. 1-800-989-8255. First, let's go to the audience here.
I have heard, I don't know if this is true, that 90% of the electricity that is produced is lost in transit over the wires. If that statistic is accurate, is there research underway to produce more efficient wiring systems which would enable more of the renewably produced energy to reach homes?
No, line loss is not 90%. It's more in the very small percentage range. But actually, to get to your question, there are companies looking at superconductive wires to be able to carry more energy across the existing lines and right-of-ways, and there are a number of innovations to be able to do more with the infrastructure we have.
Let me go to the phones to Andrew in Fayetteville, see if I can get to Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hi, Andrew, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, good. Have you got a question for us? Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I had first off, a comment and then a question. The comment was for addressing research needs in alternative energy, and I think that, I know that Department of Energy in February is doing a large funding for the sequencing of the soybean genome, which is soybean oil as the main basis for biodiesel. So I really think there is, in government, both state and federal, need, and the politicians and the people who make the decisions see a need for alternative energy. So I think that is a lot better. But my main question, I think that a lot of people should have concern with, is the effects that converting our consumption of electricity and energy sources to alternative energy sources will have on our economy, especially in New York. How much of effect, because the economy is so based around oil, from gas stations to people going to the service industry. There's so many jobs based in petroleum processing and all of these things. So how much of the impact is going to be to, alternative energy? How much of the impact is it going to be on the New York state economy?
That's a good question, because that's what we hear all the time is the greatest argument against making these kinds of changes. Neil, have you got an answer for that?
Yeah, there were comments going back in the 70s about the Clean Water Act, that if we introduced the Clean Water Act, we would lose potentially a million jobs. And what happened in response to that is we lost very few jobs, but we created an industry that is a $200 billion a year industry today. And in my mind, there's absolutely no question that if we put the appropriate level of resources in the area of renewable energy, we're going to create a market, we're going to create a technology, we're going to create opportunity that's going to lead to tremendous growth. The realistic thing in the future is that it's not a gallon of gas today at $3 and a barrel at $74.50. The reality is that in 10 years we could be facing a barrel at $350 and a gallon of gas at $10. We need to do something today.
Mm-hmm. And with with the oceans rising, what price do you put on recovering cities around the world?
Ira, no question about it. I mean, we've lost, there was a recent article in Science, 9% of our glaciers we lost in the last decade. Mm-hmm. The projections are that ocean level is going to rise 2 to 3 feet over the next 100 years. We're talking about potentially the global climate increasing by half a degree a decade as we move forward. These things are going to create cost to society of immeasurable quantities and consequence.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this side on our audience. Yes, sir.
Yes. I wanted to address my question to Bill Moore. Bill, actually, we met one time at a friend's wind turbine party where we all wore little pinwheels on our head. And it was last fall. And
I wasn't wearing a pinwheel, I don't think.
That pinwheel wasn't in your drink there? Okay.
My question to you at that time was about the danger to birds, and there is a lot of controversy around the wind turbines. I live in Cape Vincent, and right now we have a couple towns around us, and even in Canada where they're putting some up, and there's a lot of this NIMBY going on about the flying ice that's going to fly off the turbines and kill people, and the noise and all that stuff, and maybe we ought to address that side of a little bit in front of a national audience. I have to tell you, as you drive through Lowville, as I do, and I see those turbines up there metaphorically blowing global warming away, it really is good.
All right, Bill, what about the birds' concern and the ice coming off?
Our consulting ornithologist suggests that about 2 birds per turbine per year will likely be killed by collisions with the towers or the blades. You know, that's regrettable, but it's not biologically significant. And I think that we've got a lot of experience from operating wind farms around the world to support the expectation that this wind farm in Lewis County will also have a similar low level of impact on the local avian population. It's a bit of a urban myth that wind turbines will be, I think, bird cues and arts was the unfortunate phrase used by the Wall Street Journal long ago. It's never happened, with the exception of one wind farm in the Altamont Pass in California, for reasons specific to that particular location. So I think that clearly the greatest threat to our various bird and bat species in the northern climes is from business as usual in the energy sector. We've got Tug Hill has the most acidic precipitation, acid rain and acid snow, of any place in the country. And I think there's research going on here at ESF to show that
Stands of sugar maples in the North Country are being essentially attacked by the acid precipitation there. So it's business as usual, and it's consumption of fossil fuels that is really the bigger threat, loss of habitat and the like, the biggest threat to our bird populations in northern New York.
Talking about energy conservation this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato in Syracuse. Let's see if we can get... he's back. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'm back. my question is about the ozone layer and the effect of the fossil fuels on the ozone layer. Obviously, we're facing global warming problems. You mentioned, I think it was 4% of the glaciers have melted within the past decade. What if we were to move towards more environmentally friendly fuels? What would be the effect on the ozone layer? I mean, is there a way that the ozone layer can, if we give it the chance, I guess, almost repair itself, or will it always be damaged, but we won't damage it anymore?
All right, got about a minute for a response. Anybody want to tackle that one? Neil?
Well, I think that there are really two issues. There's the issue of global warming, and then there's the ozone layer. And I think the issue with the ozone layer is to a large degree associated with both the Arctic cap and the Antarctic cap. And there are a whole bunch of reasons as to why we're getting depletion of that ozone layer. The issue, I think, primarily with fuels is the issue of potential global warming. And within the last year, I believe we had a 3 part per million increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I think there isn't... the vast majority of scientists believe that we as society have an impact on the climate and that we can reduce that impact. And that's really what I think we've got to focus on.
Well, I'd like to thank all my panelists today for joining us. Neil Murphy, president of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. William Moore, director of development for PPM Energy, one of the developers of the Maple Ridge Wind Farm here in New York State. Edward Bogush is the executive director of the Syracuse Center of Excellence in Environmental Energy Systems at Syracuse University. Carol Murphy, Executive Director of the Alliance for Clean Energy in New York. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington and Charles Berquist in New York. Becky Vlamis and Megan Moline worked the phones for us today, and we'd like to thank our host today, the WRVO stations. Please support your local public radio stations here, and the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry. Thank you all for making us feel so welcome today. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, fourth floor, New York, New York, 10036. You can also surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we are podcasting and blogging, and you can also download a podcast if you missed any of the back editions of Science Friday and listen when you'd like to. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, free teaching materials we put together for you to help teach science in your classes using Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato in Syracuse.